edition of the Spotlight from Mikko Vitahve and the entire team. It's goodbye until next time.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details. Now we enlighten you with verses 162 to 165 of chapter Al-An'am from the Holy Quran, recited by Murtaza Fatemi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. قل إن صلاتي ونسكي ومحياي ومماتي لله رب العالمين لا شريك له وبذلك أمرت وأنا أول المسلمين قل أغير الله أبغي ربا وهو رب كل شيء ولا تكسب كل نفس إلا عليها ولا تزر وازرة وزر أخرى ثم إلى ربكم مرجعكم فينبئكم بما كنتم فيه تختلفون وهو الذي جعلكم خلائف الأرض ورفع بعضكم فوق بعض درجات ليبلوكم صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful. Say, surely my prayer and my sacrifice and my life and my death are all for Allah, the Lord of the worlds. No associate has He, and this am I commanded, and I am the first of those who submit. Say, what shall I seek, a Lord other than Allah? And He is the Lord of all things, and no soul earns evil but against itself, and no bearer of burden shall bear the burden of another. Then to your Lord is your return, so He will inform you of that in which you differed. And He it is who has made you successors in the land and raised some of you above others by various grades, that He might try you by what He has given you. Surely your Lord is quick to requite evil, and He is most surely the forgiving, the merciful.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Iran's leader says the country will continue to develop peaceful atomic capacities, dismissing Western claims that Tehran seeks a nuclear weapon. People in the U.S. city of Minneapolis mourn Amir Locke, a young African-American shot dead by police earlier this month. And police in Canada warn the protesters occupying downtown Ottawa of an impending crackdown. Protesters defy the threats. Hello everyone, thank you for tuning in to World News. Our top story, the leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, rejects Western claims that Iran is seeking a nuclear weapon, once again affirming that Tehran's nuclear program is entirely peaceful. Ayatollah Khamenei also noted Iran will further develop its peaceful nuclear capacity to maintain its independence. Sooner or later, the leader added, the Islamic Republic will be in need of nuclear energy. Ayatollah Khamenei recalled that he had cautioned negotiators to include certain points in the initial deal drawn up back in 2015, but that those cautions were not heeded and therefore led to subsequent problems. He pointed out to production, collective efforts, and diplomacy as a way forward to neutralize the effects of economic pressure and sanctions. Political analyst Mostafa Khoshchesh says that the U.S. is seeking to use Iran's nuclear program to demonize the Islamic Republic and to contain its regional and missile power.
What the Iranian leader said was reiterating once again that Iran is very much resolved to maintain its peaceful nuclear program. Despite the many inspections that have been carried out on Iranian nuclear, civilian nuclear industries, that included the largest number of man hours of inspections before the JCPOA and after that, of course. United States is just using the Iranian nuclear program in order to demonize Iran without providing any kind of proof in order to advance its containment program that consists of the ultimate objective of containing Iran's power components in various areas of nuclear industry, regional power and missile power. So Iran is in the know. Iran knows what they are doing, and it wants to, you know, diffuse their containment plan if possible. If not, as the Iranian Supreme Leader reiterated, the main road towards salvation and getting rid of these pressures is diffusing the sanctions and the impact of this weapon of choice for the United States that's reinvigorating the Iranian economy.
Iran and the remaining signatories to the 2015 deal, known as the JCPOA, continue talks in the Austrian capital to revive the accord. Ali Bagherikani, Iran's top negotiator, has called on other parties to be realistic and avoid excessive demands. Tehran also insists that the revival of the accord hinges on the removal of U.S. sanctions. Earlier, we spoke to our Vienna-based correspondent, Homolezgi, for some details.
Mr. Bagheri, after a long time of no tweets or no official comments, did make a tweet yesterday, last night, and you just referred there to the comments that he made, saying that now is the time for decisions. And this just after we heard the French foreign minister saying that it's Iran that has to be making the political decisions. Now, Mr. Bagheri saying that now is the time for the Western sides, and sources have been saying this for some time now, particularly the U.S., to make the necessary political decisions to get things moving. The sources close to the talks are saying that an agreement is indeed within reach. Yesterday, the Chinese delegate addressing reporters here said that he believes that we are in the last stage of the negotiations and it's just days away. And however, sources say there are still a few remaining issues that need to be resolved. And we're hearing, of course, one of them is the issue of guarantees that the U.S. will not violate the JCPOA again, will not withdraw from it again, if that is possible. And we're also, of course, hearing that among the other remaining issues is the scope of sanctions that have been imposed when it comes to individuals and various entities under other labels, Iran insisting on its demand that it wants all of those sanctions to be removed. So those are among the issues that are still up for discussions and negotiations. But as far as Iran is concerned, if the political decision is made, we're not very far now from an agreement to restore the JCPOA.
In Albania, concerns are growing over the criminal activities of the anti-Iran terrorist group known as Mujahideen Haq organization. A judicial document leaked by Albanian media said an MKO member, that is, has been prosecuted for armed robbery. The document says the MKO member has admitted to robbing a bar and a pharmacy last year. The document specifies the member has previous convictions. The latest controversy comes 2 months after reports emerged that other MKO members based in a camp near the capital, Tirana, were involved in human trafficking and drug smuggling between 2019 and 2021. Albanian media said the country's police have alerted the U.S. embassy of the group's involvement in criminal activities. The Albanian police, though, have denied sending any letter to the American embassy without elaborating. Critics in Albania blame the U.S. for providing protection for the terrorist cult. U.S. removed the MKO from its terror blacklist in 2012. The group now enjoys freedom of activity in the U.S. and Europe, and even holds regular meetings where European and American officials make speeches. Olsi Jazishi is an Albanian historian and social activist. He joined us earlier to provide more details of the latest controversy surrounding the MKO terror group. He says the MKO, supported by the U.S. embassy, frequently bribes or blackmails Albanian prosecutors and police to escape prosecution.
Reports have been leaked from Albanian police where a number of high commanders of the Mujahideen command, people like Narges Abrishamci, who is the sister-in-law of Mariam Rajavi and the sister of her first husband, Mehdi Abrishamci, and the other top commanders of the Mujahideen, they have been arrested for smuggling drugs to Italy. Other commanders have been arrested for taking illegal refugees from Greece and sending them to Italy and then to France. We don't know who these people are. They can be jihadi fighters of Daesh and ISIS. They can be suicide bombers. They can be people who have committed huge human rights violations and crimes in Syria. And this is so worrying for the Albanian government, the Albanian police. Now, the case against the Mujahideens has been continuing for a number of years in Albania. But in the past, Mujahideens have been very good on bribing our prosecutors, on using the U.S. embassy in Albania to blackmail Albanian prosecutors, judges, and police. But now this issue has exploded because this is huge.
A grand jury in the U.S. city of Austin, Texas, has indicted several police officers for using excessive force during anti-racism protests in 2020. Prosecutors did not say how many police officers were indicted. However, Austin police say 19 officers are facing charges. The city council has also agreed to pay millions of dollars to two protesters who sustained headshot wounds during the protests. A district attorney for Austin says many protesters injured by law enforcement were innocent bystanders. Demonstrations took place in May of 2020 after the murder of African-American George Floyd in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Floyd died after a white cop knelt on his neck for over 9.5 minutes. People in the U.S. city of Minneapolis hold a funeral for Amir Locke, a young black man killed at the hands of police earlier this month. Hundreds, including friends and family, attended the ceremony this Thursday. Anger boiled over the police's use of a no-knock warrant. That's a practice which does not require police officers knock and give any occupant a chance to open the door. And that's how police acted when they raided Amir Locke's apartment in Minneapolis. Now his parents want President Joe Biden to advocate for a national ban on no-knock warrants in the name of their son.
America, hear us clearly. Justice for Amir Locke. Justice for Amir Locke. And we're passing that no-knock warrant bill. We'll pass in this name, and it's going to save millions of lives. Thank you all.
Locke, 22 years old, was killed in a police raid on February the 2nd. His death is the latest in a series of incidents involving U.S. police and leading to fatalities among African Americans. Those deaths have further ignited anger at racial discrimination in the U.S., where protests have taken place calling for equality. Calls have been growing since May 2020 when African American George Floyd was choked to death by a white police officer in Minneapolis. Pro-Russian forces based in Ukraine's eastern region of Donbas say the government troops have shelled a village near Donetsk City with artillery. Pro-Russian forces have also accused the military of firing artillery and mortars in two more incidents and violating a Donbas ceasefire. That's why the military says it's recorded 60 truce violations by pro-Russian forces over 24 hours. It also says a soldier has been injured. A ceasefire has been in place over the past years to stop fighting in the east of Ukraine, which broke out in 2014. Russia has expressed concern over the latest flare-up taking place amid tensions between Moscow and the West. Those tensions have been escalating as the West has accused Russia of planning an invasion of Ukraine, an allegation Moscow denies. Earlier, our Brussels correspondent Jerome Hughes joined us with an update on the West-Russia tensions over Ukraine.
And we see a buildup of NATO troops further and further east, which is very provocative, analysts say, in terms of Russia's position. But you see the rhetoric is being constantly built up. I mean, Liz Truss talked about the fact that Joe Biden said last week that Nord Stream 2, that it will be blocked if there is an invasion of Ukraine. And of course, the West talks a lot about, you know, Ukraine being a sovereign, independent, autonomous nation, which is fair enough. But at the same time, you have a private contract between Germany and Russia in terms of Nord Stream 2, a gas pipeline, which has nothing to do with the EU. It has nothing to do with the United States. And yet you have Joe Biden saying that it will be blocked. Well, where's the autonomy? Where's the independence of Germany? Where's the respect for Germany's independence in this regard? And then you have Liz Truss parroting the same sentiments just in the past hour. So there's a lot of hypocrisy going here. And as EU leaders meet and as NATO defense ministers hold their final day of meetings here in Brussels today as well, it's clear that there are divisions.
Police in Canada have detained a number of demonstrators in the capital, Ottawa, as truckers and their supporters continue to block roads to protest COVID restrictions. Arrests come less than 2 hours after the city's police chief warned protesters of imminent action to clear them from downtown Ottawa. Truckers opposing COVID vaccine mandates, known as the Freedom Convoy, have blocked roads in the capital's downtown area for nearly 3 weeks and temporarily shut border crossings with the United States. Prime Minister Justin Trudeau has warned that the move is threatening public safety and damaging the country's economy. And earlier we spoke to international human rights lawyer Edward Corrigan, who briefed us on efforts by the Canadian government to put an end to these anti-vaccine demonstrations.
The government is, for the first time, invoking the Emergency Act. It's never been used before, so it still has to be explored and tested. The Canadian Civil Liberties Association is launching a challenge to the court saying that, to the law saying that it's unconstitutional and it is not proportional. You have the, there's some argument to say that this is maybe an overreaction on the part of the government, but the law is the government invokes it, then it has to be debated, and the debate's going to take place on Monday. If the parliament passes it, it maintains it. If they reject it, then the law ends. It's only enforced for 30 days, but it does allow seizure of bank accounts, seizure of trucks, taking away driver's licenses. Also, it prevents children from being involved because there's a lot of children actually living in the trucks and staying with the protesters. And it prevents people from providing fuel, food, and other material assistance to the truckers.
And now Saudi Arabia launches yet another airstrike on Yemen, this time targeting Sana'a province. At least one civilian was killed in the latest attack, which took place in the early hours of Friday. It followed another strike, which hit Hajjah province. No reports have come out about the Hajjah attack. Saudi Arabia and its allies launched war on Yemen in March 2015, devastating the country's key infrastructure. Conflict has left hundreds of thousands of Yemenis dead, mostly civilians. Millions more have been displaced, while half the population faces hunger. UN says that Yemen is now the largest humanitarian crisis in the world. UN warns that millions of Yemenis face more cuts in humanitarian aid in coming months because of funding shortages, which could reduce food rations in the war-torn country. Abdul Latif Al-Washali reports from Sana'a.
The United Nations aid chief Martin Griffiths said the humanitarian operations in Yemen is about to start doing a lot less. In his latest briefing to the UN Security Council, he warned that the aid agencies are quickly running out of money, forcing them to slash life-saving programs. His remarks has sparked harsh reactions in Yemen. Since January, the World Food Programme has reduced rations for 8 million of the 13 million Yemenis it feeds each month. Griffiths said rations may be cut further from March or even stopped, meaning that millions of Yemenis may die of hunger. The reduction in food rations comes with millions of people in Yemen facing starvation as a result of the ongoing years-long Saudi war and the blockade imposed on the country. As observers say, the United Nations may announce a death sentence for millions of Yemenis if gaps in its funding are not filled. They warn that if the world body wants to save more lives in Yemen, it must reduce the operational expenses of its agencies that deplete the humanitarian funding. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
And that's it for your latest, everyone. Thank you for joining us here on World News.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
the supplication on Fridays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, the first before the bringing forth and the giving of life, and the last after the annihilation of all things. The All-Knowing who forgets not him who remembers him, and decreases not him who thanks him, and disappoints not him who supplicates him, and cuts not off the hope of him who hopes in him. O Allah, I call thee to witness, and thou art sufficient witness. And I call to witness all thy angels, and the inhabitants of thy heavens, and the bearers of thy throne, and thy prophets, and thy messengers, whom thou hast sent out, and the various kinds of creatures thou hast brought forth, that I bear witness that thou art Allah. There is no God but thou, thou alone, who hast no associate nor any equal, and thy word has no failing nor any change. And that Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, is thy servant and thy messenger. He delivered to the servants that with which thou charged him, and he struggled for Allah as is his due. And he gave the good news of the truth of reward, and he warned of the veracity of punishment. O Allah, make me firm in thy religion as long as thou keepst me alive, and make not my heart to swerve after thou hast guided me, and give me mercy from thee. Surely thou art the giver. Bless Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, and make me one of his followers and his partisans, and muster me in his band, and give me the success of accomplishing the obligatory observance of Friday, and performing the acts of obedience which thou hast made incumbent upon me within it, and receiving the bestowal which thou hast apportioned for its people on the day of recompense. Thou, only thou, art the mighty wise.
In the limelight.
A similar fate awaits illegal Zionist regime. In spite of its arsenal of nuclear warheads and over-militarization by the U.S., which will not be able to guarantee for long the existence of the Zionist entity, in the face of the iron resolve of the Palestinian people and the rest of the Ummah for liberation of Beit al-Muqaddas. Dear listeners, what you heard was part of an article written by Kayhan International staff writer. This article is published under the heading Desperate Attempts of Ruthless Regimes to Avert the Inevitable. Stay tuned for more. Desperate indeed are the attempts of repressive regimes to try to stave off their fast approaching end. Of the two ruthless regimes on the brink of extinction, one is miserably self-humiliating and totally alienated from the population, to the extent that it clings to the aprons of others to continue its brutal repression of the people in the vain hope of survival. The other illegal regime has been militarized so dangerously by its godfathers that it may implode any moment, despite its genocide of the sons of the soil and its frequent air raids and missile attacks on neighboring lands. Now these two, after having established a natural diplomatic ties, are openly ganging up with each other to savagely suppress the aspirations of freedoms of the people they illegally rule. A couple of months ago, when Palestinian Muslims were being tear-gassed and fired upon by the Zionist troops in the sacred precincts of Al-Aqsa Mosque, the Zionist regime's aggressors were being unmanly cheered by Bahraini officials present on the scene and treasonously baying for more Muslim blood. Why? Because if the Palestinians succeed in liberating their usurped land or parts of it, this will bring the day of reckoning nearer for the Al-Khalifa minority regime in Bahrain. And now we have the news that the regime of pirate origin in Manama has appointed an Israeli naval officer for the first time in an Arab state to provide security to it. In a statement recently, the Bahraini foreign minister said the appointment of an Israeli officer is to secure the freedom of navigation in the region, protect international trade, and confront terrorism. What a bizarre statement. Terrorists being asked by terrorists to confront what they view as terrorism against them. The wordings are crystal clear. It means that the overwhelming majority of Bahrain that is peacefully demanding democratic rule and restoration of their birthrights are terrorists. Vice versa, the people of Palestine groaning under the jackboots of the illegal Zionist migrants from Eastern Europe for the past 7 decades and refusing to submit to the usurpers of their homeland are terrorists. Mind-boggling definitions indeed. But would these comrades in crimes against humanity succeed in their bid to prolong their precarious existence? The answer is a big no, especially when one sees the importance of the U.S. Fifth Fleet in Manama and the need for the Zionist regime's naval presence in the Persian Gulf state, which sooner than later will witness the humiliating end of a ruthless and repressive regime. A similar fate awaits illegal Israel, in spite of its arsenal of nuclear warheads and over-militarization by the U.S., which will not be able to guarantee for long the existence of the Zionist entity in the face of the iron resolve of the Palestinian people and the rest of the Ummah for liberation of Beit al-Muqaddas.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Midstream.
what the Secretary General of Lebanon's Hezbollah, Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, said during his interview with Al Alam channel about activating the air defense system of the resistance was remarkable. Although such threats against the Zionist entity were not new, the capabilities that the resistance now owns in quantity and quality is unparalleled in the history of the resistance and cannot be simply eliminated. There is no doubt that the 2006 war was a very important historical moment for the Lebanese resistance Hezbollah. However, after 2006, Martyr Commander Imad Mughniyi said that the time when the entity could wage wars in the way it did in 2006 is long gone. Mind you, in that year, Hezbollah's surprise in the battlefield was the Kornet, where the famous massacre of Merkava tanks in the field of Ikhyan village took place. The resistance has been talking for a while about the many capabilities it possesses, and His Eminence Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah has repeated several times the term surprises that will happen in any future battle. However, the latest reveal concerning the activation of air risk it will now be taking every time one of its war jets or even spy drones violates Lebanese airspace. What really concerns the Israeli entity is that Hezbollah disclosed air defense systems that it has acquired had succeeded during recent years in delivering them to Lebanon via Syria. It is a massive reveal by military standards, expressed through the operation of these systems in a clear and public manner without concealment, unlike cases in the past. Which indicates troubling intentions and worrying maneuvering trends. Since the vision report, with its remarkable eye, there is confirmation that Hezbollah succeeded in obtaining air defense systems sponsored and facilitated by Syria and Iran, including Russian-made SAM-8 and SAM-17 air defense systems, among others. The systems would threaten and disrupt the activity of the Israeli Air Force violations over Lebanon and aim to shoot down planes on the day of command. In reference to the war, it is estimated, according to the same report, that Hezbollah operatives received practical training on air defense systems inside Syrian territory. Meanwhile, Israeli security officials recently stressed that the Israeli army will not give up what they audaciously referred to as their freedom to operate in the skies of Lebanon to gather intelligence information related to threats, including Hezbollah's missile accuracy project. There's no dispute that Israel's disclosure of new variables of strategic importance related to the growth of Hezbollah's capacity to new levels would eventually bring the resistance closer to its immediate operational position intended to harm the jewel in the crown of the Israeli occupation forces, that is, its air force. Welcome to the Middle East Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. In an unprecedented acknowledgement of doubting the superiority of its own air force in the skies of Lebanon, Israel confirmed that it had received Hezbollah's messages that posed a threat to the Israeli air force and its freedom of movement, putting it in what it referred to as a finger in Israel's eye, with the resistance in Lebanon deliberately revealing air defense systems in its possession. The announcement by the Secretary General of Hezbollah, Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, about the activation of the air defense systems of the resistance sparked a debate inside the Israeli entity about the remaining freedom its air force is capable of having to continue spying over Lebanon or to target Syria from Lebanese airspace. To discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Abbas Zain, journalist and producer and an expert in the axis of resistance news. Thank you very much for being with us, Mr. Abbas. Now, Israel has warned of, quote, changing trends, end quote, in the deterrence equation in the Lebanese arena, which would place heavy burdens and maybe uneasy risks on the Israeli occupation's air force, the jewel of the occupation, preventing it from pursuing its violation of Lebanese airspace, as it has been doing for the past four to seven decades, whether with warplanes or drones, knowing the evil that Israel always works with. I am pretty sure that they will not accept this new equation. How do you think they will handle it?
I think that Israel will not accept any disruption to its usual aggression against Lebanon. After the Israeli war on Lebanon in 2006, new deterrence equations were imposed on Israel, which it tried to adapt inside the internal Lebanese arena and in the other arenas throughout the Arab world through the intertwining of the axis of resistance. As you mentioned in your report, Israel will not accept any development that affects that Israel considers it during the course of the Israel-Arab war. So the Israel is one of the weapons that Israel is most interested in while confronting its enemies. Therefore, after 2006, not only at the level of the air defense or the resistance in Lebanon, but at all levels, Israel tried to break any new equation, whether inside or outside the Lebanese arena. For example, Israel's support for the war against Syria and its support of the overthrow of the government of confronting any development in the resistance due to the intertwining between the resistance in Lebanon, the Syrian Arab Army, and Iran as well. On the domestic level as well, the situation in Lebanon falls within the framework of the pressures exerted by Israel for the sake of barter. In the sense of what Sayyid Nasrallah mentioned during his interview with Al Alam TV is not only related to the issue of air defense. He also mentioned that there are pressures being exerted on the other countries concerned with the Lebanese issue. For example, he spoke about the request of Benny Gantz, the Israeli Minister of War, from French President Emmanuel Macron to not submit any assistance to Lebanon except if certain conditions were met. What are the conditions? These conditions relate to the balances of deterrence and the development of capabilities of the resistance. Israel seeks to barter in this fight. In short, Israel is trying to prevent these equations and prevent the resistance balance of deterrence from developing on many areas, some of which are security and some are military related to Syria and Lebanon, and others are political and economic by putting pressure on Lebanon and the area in which Hezbollah moves inside Lebanon.
Well, Mr. Abbas,
we did hear Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah saying that, and I quote here, the resistance air defense force has given very effective results since it was activated 2 years ago, reiterating that the resistance considers that it is interested in possessing any weapon that would enable it to defend Lebanon and the people of Lebanon. So it has been activated for the past 2 years. Why announce it now, though? What changed to make it a necessity to publicize the activation, since obviously already Israel knew about Hezbollah having this sort of weapon?
If you want to talk theoretically, in the military and security-wise, the announcement of a specific weapon, especially in conflicts similar to the conflict between the resistance in Lebanon and the Israeli enemy, the announcement of certain armament capabilities means that there is something greater than what was mentioned that is still hidden. Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah's announcement of the activation of the Air Defense Force without specifying the type of this weapon and how it was activated, left the Israelis with many speculations. But he added that the Israelis do not know how many missiles the resistance has, nor do they know the capabilities of the resistance in particular. The timing of such an announcement, in theory, means that there are more hidden details still unrevealed. Especially since the Israeli media, citing security and military sources in the occupation, has spoken extensively in recent months about the type of specific weapons that Hezbollah possesses related to air defense. Therefore, Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah came along to say, yes, we do have air defense weapons, confirming the Israeli reports, but at the same time, leaving the Israelis confused. Yes, Sayyid Nasrallah spoke about air defense, but does the resistance only possess this type of weapon, or does it actually have greater capabilities than what was announced? This is from a security and military view. But there are also those who spoke about the issue being linked to the development of deterrence equations. I mean, Mr. Nasrallah spoke during the interview about something related to Syria. He said that there are still problems in Syria that must be resolved. And I think that he hinted at that time to the Israeli raids, which could be dealt with differently at a certain stage. And this is what the Israeli media took very seriously by noting that it's possible that Hezbollah has already deployed air defense systems on the border with Syria, which might be activated at a later time.
Mr. Abbas, we did also read, according to an Israeli report coming from the Israeli Intelligence Department or Division, with a very remarkable title that says "A Finger in the Eye of Israel," there is the confirmation that Hezbollah has succeeded in obtaining these weapons, this system of air defense, and it was facilitated by both Syria and Iran, including, the report said, Russian-made S-8, SAM-8, and SAM-17 air defense systems, among others. But could this move be considered one relevant to the entire axis of resistance, or rather just to Hezbollah?
Let us think the same way the Israeli mind thinks, which looks at the region within an intertwined axis. The political, security, and military levels of Israel are talking about an existential threat from Palestine, Lebanon, Syria, Iraq, Yemen, and Iran, obviously. Any development that affects any faction in the axis of resistance affects all factions. Therefore, Israel deals with the development of the air capabilities of Hezbollah or any party in the resistance axis on the basis that what is happening is related to the resistance axis as a whole, especially since in recent years the fronts have been greatly intertwined, and we have noticed this, in the Battle of Saif al-Quds, like the indirect interventions through unknown missiles fired from Lebanon and others launched from Syria. Even Iraq entered the equation, and Yemen as well. So the entire axis of resistance is being dealt with on the basis of its formation of an existential threat to the Israeli occupation entity in a homogeneous manner. Therefore, the development of missiles that the Israeli occupation speaks about is not only related to Hezbollah, but it's also related to Syria, Palestine, or Iraq at a later stage. There is also a government in Sana'a that speaks about surprises it is preparing for the occupation entity in Palestine, and so does Iraq.
It remains to be seen what kind of a year this will be for Israel. I want to thank you very much, Mr. Abbas Zain, journalist and producer, expert in the axis of resistance news. Thank you very much for being with us. Now, please stay tuned, because next we will be talking about Gaza's strong foundation.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marwa Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
Well, the Strong Foundation 2 maneuver conducted by the Palestinian resistance factions in the Gaza Strip during the last days of 2021 is not comparable to the previous exercises in the past years, whether in context, timing, or objectives. Therefore, the messages that it inferred, whether to the enemy or to the friend, were different as well. The resistance, in light of the continuous stumbling in the issues of reconstruction and prisoner swap, which threatens to escalate again, wanted to make sure that the occupation understands that it is ready for any new round and that it operates as a one man's heart in any upcoming standoff. Now, despite the fact that this development occurred weeks ago, but my trip to Tehran to participate in the second anniversary of General Soleimani's martyrdom, followed by covering the 43rd anniversary of the Islamic Revolution on the Middle East stream, delayed this truly important development on my show. However, we never forget what our regional resistance does to protect its natives. So here's the second edition of Gaza's Strong Foundation in this following report.
11 military factions participated in the second edition of the Strong Foundation military drills in the besieged Gaza Strip on the last week of 2021. The drills, which continued with live ammunition for days, concluded amid hot battlefield conditions and a political atmosphere fraught with complications, at least in the tense Gaza reconstruction file and the faltering prisoner exchange deal. At the site of the Qassam martyrs, which extends over hundreds of thousands of meters in the far west of the city of Rafah and the southern Gaza Strip, hundreds of soldiers in uniform and without bandanas to distinguish their party affiliations gathered, led by dozens of military leaders of the resistance factions. One Wednesday afternoon, the field officers stood on a map and model of the field of operations, showing the military leaders the plan for the maneuver and its objectives before asking permission to launch its activities. Orders were as follows. The combat groups of various specializations will carry out a simulation of landing behind enemy lines with the aim of capturing Israeli occupation soldiers. The fire support teams will have to neutralize the dangers that surround them. The military commander gave permission, and the intrusion unit began to advance in the field through a previously dug underground tunnel. In the field, three tanks appeared, similar in size and shape to the Israeli Merkava. And in the sky, a drone is trying to thwart the attack. Within a few minutes, the operation began by storming the military base. Then the support units intervened to cover the withdrawal of the resistance fighters who carried a captured soldier on their shoulders. 27 minutes of virtual combat in which combat units trained with live ammunition to use all types of weapons, including heavy machine guns, individual weapons, IEDs, mortars, and RPGs, in addition to improvised explosive devices and grenades. The fighters, who were a mixture of all military arms, showed remarkable harmony and flexibility in the field, which indicates a great progress in the level of field coordination between the military factions. Those factions had joined 3 years ago in a single formation called the Common Room of the Resistance Factions, in whose name Ayman Naufal, commander in the Al-Qassam Brigades, spoke in his first public appearance since he was released in a complex escape from Egyptian prisons in 2011. Naufal said that the strong foundation maneuver sends messages to the enemy and the friend. To the friend, that the resistance has placed the issue of prisoners on the priority list of the joint room of the resistance factions, and to the enemy, that the walls and engineering measures it is taking on the borders of the Gaza Strip will not protect it. The resistance chose to end off 2021 with a number of messages, the most important of which is that the approach of kidnapping Israeli occupation soldiers to liberate the Palestinian prisoners is not up for discussion in the face of the pressure of life requirements in Gaza, and that the exchange deal must take place according to the rules set by the factions, which are prisoners in exchange for soldiers, not soldiers in exchange for reconstruction.
Well, to discuss this issue with us in Beirut is Mr. Ihsan Ataya, representative of the Palestinian Islamic Jihad in Lebanon. Thank you very much for being with us, Mr. Ihsan. Now, 11 military arms participated in the second edition of the Strong Foundation maneuvers, which continued with live ammunition for days in the besieged Gaza Strip in the last week of 2021. What makes this military drill different than the former ones that Israel seems very concerned about?
Certainly, the military drills that took place in Gaza carried multiple messages in different directions. It was carrying basic messages to the Zionist enemy that the Palestinian resistance is present and ready for any confrontation and ready to achieve more surprises against the Zionist enemy, especially since the Battle of Sword of Al-Quds and the subsequent retraction of the Zionist entity to the terms of the ceasefire and reconstruction, which the Zionist enemy tried to use to punish the Palestinian people in Gaza. In this context, the resistance was able to send some messages that the attempt of the Zionist entity to undermine the achievements of Gaza will fail and cannot be allowed by the resistance, especially since it has attained important achievements and deterrent equations inside Al-Quds at the 1948 territories who rose up in the face of the occupation. This battle was able to mobilize the Palestinian people all over the world. Therefore, military drills are very important because they are an opportunity to test some types of weapons that have not been used in battles before, or in which some technical details are to be tested on the one hand. They are also messages of important morale for the Palestinian people in Gaza. These drills came to say that Gaza is still present, strong and important at the level of the resistance, and also carried a message to the allies of the resistance. saying that Gaza is ready for any decisive battle in which the Axis decides to fight. Gaza will be the spearhead in this battle. Perhaps these drills also carried messages to the normalizing traitors and to those who succumbed to the Zionist entity on the matter of signing agreements with it that would harm the interest of their people and the interest of our nation and the interest of Palestine. Therefore, these drills send many messages calling on these traitors to learn from Gaza. Since Gaza is geographically small, yet it was able to bring the Zionist enemy to its knees and torment its heart, forcing it to find mediators for a ceasefire. Even President Biden himself intervened to achieve that goal. Therefore, the normalizing traitors must understand that this enemy, who they think they are being supported by, will plunder their wealth and will turn their countries into a place of strife and problems.
Well,
but Mr. Ataya, it is evident from what you said and from what we saw from these military drills that the resistance in Gaza wants to inaugurate a new character in military action whose title is full partnership with the different factions found in Gaza, not only in the face of the Israeli threat, but in bearing also responsibility of the consequences of any proactive action that this resistance does, as the decision now is to place the liberation of prisoners along with the national red lines for Palestine. So it seems that Gaza is ready to face another aggression to liberate its people from Israeli detention centers. However, will it be able to survive another round of brutal aggression, knowing that the whole world will just turn a blind eye towards Gaza?
One of the messages of these drills was the internal message, as you mentioned, which is training and field interaction among different factions in the event of any upcoming confrontation with the occupation, especially since part of the ceasefire agreement included the issue of the prisoners' swap deal, which the enemy is trying to evade. The issue of prisoners has become a pressing and important issue in this period, especially nowadays, which may cause a real uprising inside the occupied Palestine interior against the Zionist enemy, in solidarity with these people, the prisoners who began to rise up and confront the warden with force. Therefore, these drills carry an important message to the prisoners, saying that Gaza is ready to sacrifice for the sake of liberating these prisoners. In my opinion, any upcoming confrontation, the biggest loser will be the Israeli entity. Even if Gaza bears the greatest losses at the level of buildings, infrastructure, and martyred civilians, but the Zionist enemy is one who avoids confrontation with the Palestinians. The biggest evidence of this is the issue of the Palestinian detainee who went on hunger strike, Hisham Abu Hawash, whose cause the whole world followed, and how the Israeli enemy retreated in this matter due to the threat of the Secretary General of the Islamic Jihad movement, who threatened that martyrdom of the prisoner Abu Hawash would be a reason for firing rockets at Tel Aviv and opening a battle in the face of the enemy's military. Therefore, the Zionist enemy is not interested in a military confrontation because it will be the most affected, and because any confrontation will mobilize our people in the West Bank, Al-Quds, and Palestinian interior, and will trigger a serious intifada in its face. In my opinion, the Palestinian people in Gaza have always been accustomed to sacrifice. They are patient, steadfast, and always stationed on an important front in the homeland in Palestine. They have no problem in confronting the occupation and ready at any time to confront this enemy.
Thank you very much, Mr. Hassan Ataya, representative of the Palestinian Islamic Jihad in Lebanon. All the support for Gaza and all of Palestine. Thank you for being with us. And thank you. Please stay tuned next week for more from the Middle East stream. Have a great week.
in the limelight.
The cost and consequences of America's 21st century wars have by now been well documented. A staggering $8 trillion in expenditures and more than 380,000 civilian deaths, as calculated by Brown University's Cost of War project. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by William D. Harting, writer. This article is published under the heading Corporate America Cashed In on Post-9/11 Pentagon Spending Surge. Stay tuned for the details, please. The costs and consequences of America's 21st century wars have by now been well documented. A staggering $8 trillion in expenditures and more than 380,000 civilian deaths as calculated by Brown University's Cost of War project. The question of who has benefited most from such military spending, unfortunately, has received far less attention. Corporations large and small have left the financial feast of that post 9/11 surge in military spending with genuinely staggering sums in hand. After all, Pentagon spending has totaled an almost unimaginable $14 trillion plus since the start of the Afghan war in 2001, up to one half of which, catch a breath here, went directly to defense contractors. The political climate created by the global so-called War on Terror, or GWT, as Bush administration officials quickly dubbed it, set the stage for homogeneous increases in the Pentagon budget. In the first year after the 9/11 attacks and the invasion of Afghanistan, defense spending rose by more than 10%, and that was just the beginning. It would, in fact, increase annually for the next decade, which was unprecedented in the American history. The Pentagon budget peaked in 2010 at the highest level since the Second World War, over $800 million, substantially more than the country spent on its forces at the height of the Korean or Vietnam Wars during President Ronald Reagan's vaunted military buildup of 1980s. And in the new political climate sparked by the reaction to the 9/11 attacks, those increases reached well beyond expenditures specifically tied to fighting and the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. As Harry Stone Cipher, then vice president of Boeing, told the Wall Street Journal in an October 2001 interview, "The purse is now open. Any member of Congress who doesn't vote for the funds we need to defend this country will be looking for a new job after next November." Stone Cipher's prophecy of rapidly rising Pentagon budget proved correct, and it's never ended. The Biden administration is anything but an exception. Its latest proposal for spending on the Pentagon and related defense work like nuclear warhead development at the Department of Energy topped $753 billion for FY 2022. And not to be outdone, the House and Senate Armed Services Committees have already voted to add roughly $24 billion to that staggering sum. And who benefited? The benefits of the post 9/11 surge in Pentagon spending have been distributed in a highly concentrated fashion. More than one-third of all contracts now go to just five major weapons companies, including Lockheed Martin, Boeing, General Dynamics, Raytheon, and Northrop Grumman. Those five received more than $166 billion in such contracts in fiscal year 2020 alone, To put such a figure in perspective, the $75 billion in Pentagon contracts awarded to Lockheed Martin that year was significantly more than 1.5 times the entire 2020 budget for the State Department and the Agency for International Development, which together totaled $44 billion. While it's true that the biggest financial beneficiaries of the post-9/11 military spending surge were those five weapons contractors, they were anything but the only ones to cash in. Companies benefiting from the build-up of the past 20 years also included logistics and construction firms like Kellogg, Brown & Root, KBR, and Bechtel, as well as armed private security contractors like Blackwater and DynCorp. The Congressional Research Service estimates that in FY 2020, the spending for contractors of all kinds had grown to $420 billion, or well, half of the total Pentagon budget. Companies in all three categories noted above took advantage of wartime conditions in which both the speed of delivery and less rigorous oversight came to be considered the norms. To overcharge the government or even engage in outright fraud. The best-known reconstruction and logistics contractor in Iraq and Afghanistan was Halliburton, through its KBR subsidiary. At the start of both the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, Halliburton was the recipient of the Pentagon's Logistics Civil Augmentation Program contracts. Those open-ended arrangements involved coordinating support functions for troops in the field, including setting up military bases, maintaining equipment, and providing food and laundry services. By 2008, the company had received more than $30 billion for such work. Halliburton's role would prove controversial indeed, reeking as it did of self-dealing and blatant corruption. The notion of privatizing military support services was first initiated